Welcome to the Solar IMG podcast. Today's guests are Mr. Paul Douglas, and he's an award-winning meteorologist, author, entrepreneur, and contributor to the Huffington Post. And after him, we're going to have the wonderful Sky Blue, and she's the STEM emissary mascot for the AIAA, and she's got some awesome news for all of us. But we're going to start with Mr. Douglas. Mr. Douglas, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, in your recent article on the Huffington Post, you mentioned that the weather is changing. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about that, please.
Well, we're noticing more extremes. And, you know, in the 1980s, I was skeptical about climate change. I had listened to James Hansen's testimony. Of course, Hansen is a very noted NASA scientist, and he gave some alarming testimony back in 88 at the height of the heat wave and drought. And at the time, I was a little skeptical, as any scientist is, but I noticed in the mid-90s that something was changing. The weather patterns were evolving. The rains seemed to be falling harder. We seemed to be getting more records. And I've just seen it with my own eyes here working up in Minnesota as a television meteorologist for most of the last 30 years. The winters are trending shorter. The summers are more humid. We're getting more extreme weather. And that seems to be a trend worldwide. We seem to be loading the dice in favor of more extreme weather events. You can't chalk up any extreme to climate change. But if you step back and look at the pieces of the puzzle kind of falling into place, over time, gradually, the outline of climate change really comes into view. And I think, you know, people say, well, you know, especially in Minnesota, warmer winter sounds like a pretty good thing. And I can't disagree with that. But if you warm up the atmosphere even by 1, 2, 3 degrees, you increase the amount of water vapor specifically, that the atmosphere can hold, and that increases the frequency and intensity of not only flash flooding, but every other kind of weather extreme. We've always had record highs and record lows, but what we saw in March last month with 15,200 records around the nation can't be just attributed to normal atmospheric variability. I do believe that climate change is turbocharging some of the changes that we're seeing.
Well, you know, I was on the fence personally until last month, and now we've got snow in Michigan. Some people are speaking about extreme measures, for example, fracking volcanoes to induce volcanic gases to block out sunlight, or use particulates in the atmosphere to block solar radiation and reflect it away from our planet. What do you think about these types of potential programs?
I think if we're not careful, we could make it worse. I think any time you tinker with the atmosphere on a global scale, and I've read some of these geoengineering type solutions, and it makes me nervous. You know, we may have to do something like this in 30, 40, 50 years, but I think step one is to try to wean ourselves off carbon-based fuels. We've been binging on carbon for 200 years, and now we're seeing a hangover, and the weather is biting us back. And I think the more logical, reasonable solution is to slowly wean ourselves off carbon, possibly instill some sort of a carbon tax to incentivize other forms of clean energy. It's happening. I just don't know if it's happening enough, and I fear it's going to take a couple of climate calamities before people wake up and say, yeah, this is a real problem, and we need to focus on this.
Over the course of your work, have you ever seen any correlations with Milankovitch cycles or solar maximum, perhaps?
We've looked at all the alternatives, and believe me, I wish another explanation could explain the changes that we're seeing. I think some of it is the KISS principle: keep it simple, stupid. Always go, what is it, Occam's razor? I can't remember, but
yeah.
Usually the most simple explanation is the one that turns out to be scientifically valid. Solar radiation has actually been decreasing slightly since the 1980s. And that's the first thing that climate scientists looked at, was the sun, of course. They looked at water vapor, you know, which is obviously a greenhouse gas. You know, could that by itself explain the spike that we're seeing in global temperatures? And believe me, these climate scientists, thousands of them worldwide, are very competitive. The first one that can prove to his peers or her peers that it's not AGW, that it's not anthropogenic global warming, man-made global warming, instant 7- or 8-figure payday. So there is a huge financial incentive, a huge competitive incentive for a scientist to be able to disprove that man has a connection. But this is the first time that we're seeing warming in both hemispheres, and there is no obvious astronomical trigger like there was back during the medieval warming 1,000 years ago. Yes, it was warmer some years, but that can be traced to the fact that we were actually closer to the sun. The Earth's elliptical orbit was closer to the sun. There was an astronomical reason why we warmed up. This time, there is no obvious astronomical trigger, and we can't just point to the sun and say, oh, you know, it's increased solar radiation. That is not the case. I wish it was.
Well, if we implement some sort of cap-and-trade type of program, India's starting to come up. They're going to get a competitive advantage. Wouldn't that put us at a little bit of a disadvantage? Like, I'm not saying that I don't agree with you about getting off of the carbon addiction. I think that's true, but how do we do it successfully?
Well, I think we have to be leaders. I mean, America has been a leader for 200 years or longer, and the rest of the world is going to sit on their thumbs until the United States sets an example. And, I mean, we can't point to China and India and say, all right, in the case of China, you're launching one new coal-fired power plant every week. You know, we're hypocrites. We can't look at them and say, hey, you've got to do X, Y, and Z to clean up your air. Of course, greenhouse gases don't respect international boundaries, but we need to get off the dime and implement something. And I, you know, it's above my pay grade. I'm a meteorologist. I'm not a politician. I'm not a public policy planner. But we need to incentivize clean forms of energy. And I'm all for the markets figuring this out. I think the government has a good chance of screwing this up. The government needs to set a goal and then step back and let the markets figure this out and allow Americans to do what they do best, and that's innovate. You know, we have a lot of people still looking for work who are still perpetually unemployed. Why aren't we building wind turbines in Toledo and Detroit? Why can't we get even more serious about solar? The critics, the skeptics, hold up Solyndra as a reason why this will never happen. But I'm not quite that pessimistic. I think when people realize the amount of money that they can make green by going green, that we're going to see, you know, kind of a Wild West mentality. And, I mean, it's expensive keeping this addiction. It costs money and it costs lives protecting those oil supply lines. And God forbid we go to war with Iran, or who knows what might happen 5 years, 10 years from now. You know, we put ourselves at all kinds of risk perpetuating this carbon addiction. And I think we have the technology, we have the smart minds to be able to figure out alternatives to carbon. It's going to happen. And if we're not careful, all these jobs and patents are going to go to China and South Korea and Japan and Europe, where there is no more debate about climate science. People think we're nuts. I have relatives in Germany and Denmark, and they look at me and they shake their head and they say, what are you people doing in the United States? Are you scientifically literate? Are you really going to let the deniers and the professional skeptics, many of them in the pockets of the energy industry, are you really going to let them win at the end of the day? And I don't have a good answer for that.
Well, it's pretty obvious that the status quo is for the oil. The pipelines are being built to send the unrefined crude from the tar sands in Canada to the West Coast to be refined in China, and then the Keystone XL, they're pushing. I didn't want to get too political on this, but I guess we're going all out. But that's a significant issue, the money from the energy. They want the oil. But something I found really interesting was that when I posted a link to your article on the Facebook page, it immediately tagged the Republican Party, and then, bam, there was an influx of people with ad hominem attacks. Have you had a lot of experience with this?
No, I haven't. And I'm at the point where I frankly don't care. And people that call me a rhino or Republican name only, I honestly don't care. I'm not running for office. I have no political aspirations. I wrote it from the standpoint of a moderate Republican who was simply looking at the data and reached this conclusion. But for some reason, it's threatening to a lot of people. It's threatening to their worldview. And I think Al Gore, politicized this with his movie. I think he had good intentions, but I think there are a lot of moderates out there today who say, oh my goodness, if I believe that actions have consequences and that releasing 27 billion tons of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere every year might have some implications, that makes me a liberal. That makes me an Al Gore follower. And that's bunk. It's junk, and it's just ridiculous. 10 years from now, we're going to look back on this period and say, how could so many people, God-fearing, logical, rational people, just be so far off the mark? And I don't pretend to have a corner on the truth here. And God knows I don't have the answer key. I tried to write an honest piece looking at the data. This is the conclusion that I drew. It had nothing to do with Al Gore. I am not a liberal, but I am scientifically literate, and I pride myself on that. And I'm amazed at the number of people out there that aren't and are just happy kind of wallowing in ignorance. And they go to their favorite denier websites, and they listen to their favorite denier radio talk show hosts, and they think that they know science, and they don't. We're celebrating ignorance in this country, and it's dangerous because it's going to put us at a competitive disadvantage. And you wait. 5-10 years from now, fingers will be pointing, why didn't we move faster? Well, the energy industry, God love them, they have a good thing going. They're making record profits. They don't want the gravy train to end. And they are still funding a lot of disinformation and confusion out there in the marketplace. And as for the skeptics, no matter what you write, no matter what opinion you have, there will always be trolls that hide behind their laptops and fire off nasty comments. And I'm at the point where I truly don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care. They can write what they want, and I will write what I want. And you know what? We'll come back in 10 years, and we'll see who's right.
So meanwhile, while there's a lot of opposition, anti-AGW groups taking a lot of big oil money, there's also a lack of funding for real science. We're seeing scientists getting laid off. We're seeing scientists having a hard time getting funding. We're seeing scientists who publish anything that goes against the status quo being thrown under the bus.
Yeah.
These are fundamental problems. The education systems in North America have been under the gun for decades. And what can we do? How do we continue to educate people using technologies that we have available to us?
I think, I hate to say it. I mean, we have a lot of challenges, and healthcare is one of them. But I think education reform and placing a greater emphasis on education, parents need to be vocal. Parents need to demand accountability and a merit-based system where teachers who don't cut it should not be allowed to stay. And, I was in the union for a couple of years being on television, and the unions do some good things. And I'm not anti-union, but I do believe that America was predicated and based on merit-based. People that work hard should be rewarded and promoted. In Japan, teachers are almost worshipped. They're venerated. Here in the United States, we've got great teachers and we have stinkers, people that should not be in but are riding it out until they get to their retirement or pension age. And I think it's a real problem. And so I applaud politicians and school boards and parents that demand accountability and demand better teachers. We're not really going to be competitive on a global stage until we get serious about reforming education.
Well, a lot of money is being dumped into STEM outreach, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. So the powers that be have identified a problem, and they're throwing money at it. And there's a lot of STEM outreach groups that are doing excellent work getting kids interested in science. What do you see going on this summer weather-wise for North America?
That's a great question. We're transitioning from a La Nina cooling phase, and that's another thing that was baffling. Remember back in October when word came out that we were moving into a La Nina cool phase, and the forecast from the Climate Prediction Center, from NOAA, was for another cold, snowy winter for the northern tier states. And I'm not knocking NOAA. It's hard. Anytime you go beyond a week or two, it's more art than science. But we just had the fourth warmest winter nationwide, lower 48, fourth warmest on record, in spite of a La Nina cooling phase. And now the latest predictions indicate that we may be heading into an El Nino, a warm phase, which would tend to favor another warmer winter. As for what the summer holds, you know, your choice is tornadoes or drought. And right now I'm kind of leaning toward drought, at least for the northern tier states, from the upper Midwest, the Great Lakes, the Northeast. We're just not getting the storms, the rain that we should be getting. And if I had to gamble, if I had to bet, I'd bet on drought, at least for a big chunk of the northern third of the United States. Southern U.S., I think it's going to be a hot, sticky, record summer with an unusual number of severe storms and tornadoes. And we're seeing a trend, more big, violent tornadoes east of the Mississippi, touching down in Dixie Alley, not the traditional tornado alley, which runs from Texas up to Nebraska and Iowa. And I don't know if that eastward shift is just a fluke, if it's a trend, if it's the result of more water vapor in the air. We're not seeing more big, violent tornadoes, but where they touch down seems to be shifting east, and that's a problem because they're touching down in more heavily populated areas. Joplin, Missouri, Tuscaloosa, Huntsville, Memphis, Nashville, Atlanta. You know, a lot of these folks never thought that they'd be living in Tornado Alley. And they're not as tornado-wise as residents of Kansas or Oklahoma or Texas. And so I don't know what it's going to take. I fear it's going to take a big tornado tragedy. I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago, and an engineer and a meteorologist who has studied tornadoes his entire career stood up, and he said, in our lifetime, possibly soon, a single tornado will kill 1,000 Americans. And there will be a public outcry, congressional inquiries. How could this happen? Why weren't we prepared? I'm scared to death that we're going to have a big EF4 tornado steamrolling through a major suburb or a downtown. They did simulations in Dallas back in 2002. They took an EF5 tornado, and worst case scenario, 87,000 residents of Dallas stuck in traffic in their cars in gridlock. And, you know, thousands dead, tens of thousands injured, many for life, you know, damage $30, $40, $50 billion. I mean, God forbid, it's a miracle that we haven't had that yet. And a lot of people still think that, oh, I live in a city, tornadoes don't hit cities. Nothing could be farther from the truth. A big tornado goes where it wants to go, including hitting a downtown. A few buildings won't make a bit of difference. So, you know, every tornado season I hold my breath and I pray that we'll get through this season without a major suburb or a downtown being hit. But Dallas, you know, last week, April the 3rd, when they saw, what, 13 tornadoes, some of these were big EF2s, possibly EF3s. It is a miracle that nobody was killed in those tornadoes, and I think it's a testament to the Weather Service and local broadcasters. And you know what? All those people out there now with Android phones and iPhones streaming back video, are they stupid? Yes, but it probably saved lives because people could see that this was the real deal. Yeah, there's a tornado on the ground right there. This isn't a rotation-based warning, and so I really have mixed feelings about you know, people out there putting themselves in danger, sending back video of tornadoes. They're threatening their lives, but they may be saving other lives in the process. So I really wrestle with that. If we had webcams from coast to coast and could get a live stream from any neighborhood in real time, we wouldn't have to put people in harm's way. But you know what? You can't legislate stupid. I mean, people are going to go out. They're going to do what they want to do. People have to take responsibility for their own safety. And hey, it's been a pleasure chatting with you, and
I appreciate
everything you're doing with your blog. And I certainly wish you continued success. Keep it going.
Thank you very much, Mr. Douglas.
You're absolutely welcome, and thanks for a very compelling interview. I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you. Take care.
You bet. Bye-bye now.
Our next guest is Sky Blue, and she's a STEM emissary or STEMissary at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and she works with a large group of other mascots who promote STEM education, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. Sky, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, no problem. Glad to be here.
Now, can you please just give us an overview of what the STEM programs are all about?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, when you ask a lot of kids, they will say that those are their least favorite subjects in school, mostly because people don't know how to teach them in a way that is interesting and applies to a real-world application and gives kids a way to think about why would I learn this? Actually, I had a friend who had an eighth grade teacher, and this friend didn't understand geometry at all. And she struggled and struggled and struggled. And unfortunately, when she went to ask for help from that teacher, she said, "Why do I have to learn geometry? I'm never going to use it." And the teacher said, "Because I said so, go sit down and turn your homework in." So that is one of the reasons that I go out and work with kids. So no kid will ever get an answer to a question from a teacher like that. Myself, Camilla Saito, Fuzz Aldrin, and Aurora all work together to make math and science and technology and engineering and space and weather all come alive for people, because we are out there showing the fun stuff, which then gets you into the harder stuff.
And so you guys use the social media, and there's the interactive workshops, and you're going into classrooms. What really kind of spurred this? Like, how did they identify that there was a problem with lack of interest in STEM subjects and lack of scientific literacy, and what was the whole catalyst for this?
Well, again, part of it is that if you want to see a space shuttle, you have to be in Florida. If you want to see a solar aurora, you have to be in the right part of the world to be able to see that. If you want to see an airplane take off with a space shuttle on the back of it, you have to be in a specific place. So what we try to do is place ourselves in places where we can almost be the on-scene reporters for some of those things. And then we go and look for links to other interesting STEM things that the kids and the teachers and the people that follow us can go look for further information.
And it's not just limited to kids, too. There's a lot of big kids with beards and stuff, too, you know, because I see the interaction. It was pretty interesting to see the Wallops launch and to see how that went in real time and see the unprecedented amount of interaction between folks. We had people staying up all night for nights in a row waiting for the launch, and even the controllers weren't even really aware. I said to Wallops, I said, "How does it feel being part of this unprecedented period of human history where we have this public interaction with NASA?" And they said, "Well, hey, I hadn't even thought about that." So it's really interesting to see how you guys are using social media and new technologies to engage people. And how has it really, you know, engaged the adults? What kind of feedback do you get from the teachers and the parents?
Well, it was interesting. I was at NASA Johnson in January, and I was touring with a PAO person to see what kinds of things were being shipped out of NASA Johnson. All of a sudden, across Building 9, I heard someone scream, "Sky!" And I went, "Oh, my goodness." And the next thing I know, another tour group had come up, and this woman was, like, pulling on my wings, going, "I can't believe I met you." So some days I feel like the leprechaun that somebody catches when they see me. But the cool part is that, again, a lot of the things that I get involved with are things that people do find engaging and interesting. And the big people relate very well to all of our personalities. I think when you talk about all the four of us, each of us has a distinctly different character and a different access to things. My platform has always been that girls can do it, and not to get discouraged about math or science, that anybody is smart enough. It's just you can't let someone tell you that you're not. And part of me is pigs aren't supposed to fly, but I can flap my wings and I can do anything I want. So hopefully I'm a good role model for both the kids and the adults to realize that you can really do anything.
And what,
all you got to do is work hard.
Yeah. What's it been like kind of trailblazing this new frontier of interaction and social media? Do you guys kind of make it up as you go, or is there a set plan? And are you refining this over time to kind of pass it on to the next generation of PAOs and emissaries?
Well, right now, it is a very evolving thing. And we all work together very, very well. Is there a plan? No, because each one of us are totally unique. What we are finding has happened since our balloon flight last May is that there are many other mascots that are popping up on Facebook particularly. So there are other people that have gotten the idea that this is an excellent way to get information out to the general public about things that they really hadn't thought about. For instance, when a lot of people think about NASA, they think about the space shuttle. And when the last shuttle landed, people were very, very sad. I look at it to turn it completely around, that it's an opportunity to find out all the other wonderful things that NASA does that now can come to the forefront. All of the different NASA programs have excellent educational programs that are tied to them. It's just sometimes they never really saw the light of day. So I'm really happy that we're able to spotlight different programs out there for kids, parents, teachers, the general public to take a look at and to learn something.
You touched briefly on the BTS-1 balloon, right? And I was hoping you just... It was really a fun mission to watch, and it was full of suspense and drama, and I was hoping you'd just tell everyone about the BTS balloon.
Well, wow, what can I say? I still have mud between my toes.
What was it like flying in space?
It was very exciting, and it was very scary, and I've learned... I was just on another balloon ride. Balloon rides are scary, but what I am learning is that there's an awful lot of science and math that kids can learn via these space balloon weather balloons. Our particular journey did not go as expected, and I think that everyone learned a whole lot from that journey because when you came right down to it, the error and the reason we went off course was an error in the weight calculation in the capsule. So it was a great learning experience about why you measure, and then lift off. Being in the swamp, not terribly thrilling, but we were lucky that we had a lot of people involved in our rescue, and it was very exciting. And boy, was I glad to get home and have a cupcake.
All right. Well, Skye, thanks so much for coming on to tell us about your mission and really appreciate all the work that you're doing. Where would you suggest everyone, what web resources would you suggest people go to check out the...
Well, actually, I do have something pretty exciting to talk about when you talk about resources. Absolutely, you need to go to AIAA Kids Place. There's all kinds of resources there. But there was just a press conference at Sun and Fun, and I will be flying with Think Global Flight next May, and they are going to be setting a round-the-world record. And the plane, which you can see on my Facebook page, says that they are flying for STEM education. So we hope that all of the Facebook fans that we have will follow along on this journey, because every place the airplane will sit down, there are plans that STEM lessons will be taught in the local communities. Right now, we're trying to raise money to make that flight happen. We've got a great sponsor, and it's going to be very, very exciting. I have already gotten some of my fans interested in the Think Global Flight, and we are actually planning on meeting up with some of them in various parts of the world. So it's a very, very exciting, very public outreach that everyone can follow along as we train for the flight and then as we actually fly around the world.
Cool. Well, it sounds really exciting. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. Everyone should check out Skye Bleu, BLEU, on Facebook, and Camilla Estio, Aurora PhD, and Fuzz Aldrin. They're the STEM crew. And we're looking forward to maybe getting you back on the podcast sometime to talk about the mission when it's about to happen or when it's finished.
That would be great. I would love to talk about the training for Think Global Flight, because I am very, very excited about being a part of it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Skye.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, wow, that just about wraps it up for the podcast, but I'm really glad to know that whatever challenges that we're facing in the future, we're well-equipped to handle them. Many thanks to Mr. Paul Douglas. You can check him out at huffingtonpost.com/Paul-Douglas. And you can keep up with Skye's new adventure at thinkglobalflight.org, or check her out on Facebook at Skye Bleu with a EU on Facebook. Keep it locked to solarimg.org for more info, and facebook.com/solarimg. And today's track is If I Could by drum and bass all-stars Logistics and High Contrast on the legendary Hospital Records label. Big ups to that crew. And many thanks to all our fans and supporters and everyone else who's chipped in a few dollars by clicking on the donate button at solarimg.org. Without you, we wouldn't be able to keep doing this. So much respect. In the meantime, stay warm. Peace.